of all vampires, attained his power not in the region of Wallachia, but through heresy in the monastery of Saint-Mathieu des Pyrénées Orientales, a Benedictine house found in the year 1000 of our Lord. What is this, anyway?
School paper, I repeated. But our eyes met strangely over the book, and he looked as if he was seeing me for the first time. Is your French very good?
Of course.
He smiled and bent over the page again.
Dracula is said to visit the monastery every 16 years to pay tribute to his origins and to renew the influences that have allowed him to live in death.
Go on, please. I gripped the edge of the table.
Certainly. The calculations done by Brother Pierre de Provence in the early 17th century indicate that Dracula visits Saint-Mathieu in the half-moon of the month of May.
What is the moon now? But Barley didn't know either. There was no further mention of Saint-Mathieu. Nothing else in the book looked relevant to my purposes, and when Barley glanced at his watch again, I turned sadly away from the enticing walls of volumes, and we made our way down the staircase.
Well, that was cheerful.
On the train, Barley entertained me with chat about his fellow students, a pageant of madcaps and scapegoats, then carried my bag onto shipboard for me, above the oily gray water of the channel. It was a bright, chill day, and we settled into the vinyl seats inside, sheltered from the wind. Barley informed me that he didn't sleep much during term, and promptly dozed off, with his coat rolled into a ball under one shoulder. Mrs. Clay was home when we arrived. When she suddenly opened the door and drew me inside, I hurried upstairs, calling back that I wanted to wash my face. In fact, the thought made my heart beat with guilty rapidity. I intended to sack my father's citadel at once. I would figure out later how to deal with Mrs. Clay and Barley. Now I had to find what I felt sure must be hidden there. I went into my father's room as quietly as a burglar, shut the door, and opened his desk. I rooted through the drawers, replacing each item with care as I went along. At last, my hand closed on a sealed package. I undid it shamelessly and saw a few lines inside addressed to me, and admonishing me to read the enclosed letters only in the case of my father's unexpected demise or long-term disappearance. I seized the package greedily and took my find to my own room, listening hard for Mrs. Clay's foot on the stairs. The packet was full of letters. I carefully opened the first. It was dated 6 months earlier, and it seemed to begin not with mere words, but with a cry from the heart. My dear daughter, his handwriting trembled under my eyes, if you are reading this, forgive me. I have gone to look for your mother. The train station in Amsterdam was a familiar sight to me. I'd passed through it dozens of times, but I'd never been there alone before. Mrs. Clay and Barley thought I was on my way to school. I regretted deceiving kind, boring Mrs. Clay, and I regretted even more parting from Barley. I thought I might write him a letter when all this trouble had ended, but that far ahead I could not see. For now the Amsterdam morning sparkled, gleamed, shifted around me. Even this morning I found something comforting in the walk along canals from our house to the station. The scent of bread baking and the humid smell of the canals, the not quite elegant, busy cleanliness of everything. The station was crowded by the time the express pulled up. I boarded now, clutching my school bag. I had hours ahead of me, and I was going to need them, not to read my book, but to peruse again those precious letters from my father. I believed I'd picked my destination correctly, but I needed to ruminate on why it was correct. I found a quiet compartment and drew the curtains shut along the aisle next to my seat, hoping no one would follow me in there. After a moment, a middle-aged woman in a blue coat and hat came in anyway, but she smiled at me and settled down with a pile of Dutch magazines. In my comfortable corner, watching the old city and then the little green suburbs trundle past. I unfolded again the first of my father's letters.
My dear daughter, if you are reading this, forgive me. I have gone to look for your mother. For many years I have believed she was dead, and now I am not certain about that. This uncertainty is almost worse than grief. I have never told you much about her, and that has been a weakness in me. During the last few months, I have tried to compensate for my weakness by telling you little by little what I could about my own past, and I intended to bring your mother gradually into the story. Why have I not told you all the facts of this history at a blow, to get it over with, to inform you fully? The answer lies, again, in my own weakness, but also in the fact that an abbreviated version would be exactly that, a blow. I can't possibly wish you such pain, even if it would be a mere fraction of my own. Furthermore, you might not fully believe it if I told it at a blow, just as I could not believe my advisor Rossi's story fully without pacing the length of his own reminiscences. And finally, what story can be reduced in actuality to its factual elements? Therefore, I relate my story one step at a time. I must hazard a guess, too, at how much I will have managed to tell you already if these letters come into your hands.
My father's guess had not been quite accurate, and he had picked up the story a beat or two beyond what I already knew. I might never hear his response to Helen Russi's astounding resolution to go with him on his search, I thought sadly, or the interesting details of their journey from New England to Istanbul. How, I wondered, had they managed to perform all the necessary paperwork, to clear the hurdles of political estrangement, the visas, the customs?
Six days after Rossi's disappearance, we flew to Istanbul from Idlewild Airport, changing planes in Frankfurt. I don't know exactly what I expected of Istanbul. Nothing, maybe, since I had so little time to anticipate the journey. But the beauty of the city knocked the wind out of me. It had an Arabian Nights quality that no number of honking cars or businessmen in Western suits could dissolve. By the time we found some rooms in the old quarter of Sultan Ahmet, I had received a dizzying glimpse of dozens of mosques and minarets. Bazaars hung with fine textiles, even a flash of the many-domed, four-horned Hagia Sophia billowing above the peninsula. Helen had never been here either, and she studied everything with quiet concentration, turning to me only once during the cab ride to remark how strange it was for her to see the wellspring of the Ottoman Empire, which had left so many traces on her native country. Our landlady's front hall was cool after the glare and dust of the street. She herself turned out to be a fine-featured old Armenian woman. I sank gratefully into a chair in the entrance there, letting Helen reserve two rooms in her excellent but weirdly accented French.
"Yes, we'll take the two separate rooms side by side. My brother, mon frère, ronfle affreusement."
"Ronfle?"
"Snores."
Rossi had not named the archive in his letters, and in our conversation he had called it only a little-known repository of documents dating from the era of Sultan Mehmed II. His letters added that it was attached to a 17th-century mosque. We could try to find information on such an archive at the university. She was studying my hastily purchased guidebook.
"It's too late to go to the university today. Tomorrow we can visit there and ask someone for information about archives that date from Mehmed's time. I think that will be the most efficient way."
"Let's look for some dinner. It's already past 7 and we'll need to turn in early tonight." Helen nodded, and we walked quite companionably up through the heart of the old city. Near our pension, we discovered a restaurant decorated inside with brass vases and fine tiles, with a table in the arched front window, an opening without glass where we could sit and watch people walking past on the street outside. The waiter brought us chunks of bread, a dish of smooth yogurt studded with slices of cucumber, and a strong, fragrant tea in glass vases. We ate heartily and had just moved on to roasted chicken on wooden skewers when a man with a silver mustache and a mane of silver hair, wearing a neat gray suit, entered the restaurant and glanced around. He settled at a table near us and put a book down by his plate. He ordered his meal in quiet Turkish, then seemed to take in our pleasure in our dinner and leaned toward us with a friendly smile.
"You like our native food, I see."
"We certainly do. It's excellent." he continued, turning a handsome, mild face on me.
Let me see. You are not from England. America?
Yes. Helen was silent, cutting up her chicken and eyeing our companion warily.
Ah, yes, how very nice. You are sightseeing in our beautiful city.
Yes, exactly. I concurred, wishing Helen would at least look friendly. Hostility might appear suspicious somehow.
Welcome to Istanbul.
With a very pleasant smile, he raised his glass beaker to toast us. I returned the compliment, and he beamed.
Forgive the question from a stranger, but what do you love best here in your visit?
Well, it would be hard to choose. I liked his face. It was impossible not to answer him truthfully. I'm most struck by the feeling of East and West blending in one city.
A wise observation, young man. That blend is our treasure and our curse. I have colleagues who have spent a lifetime studying Istanbul, and they say they will never have time to explore all of it, although they are living here always. It is an amazing place.
What is your profession? I had the sense from Helen's stillness that she would step on my foot under the table in another minute.
I am a professor at the Istanbul University.
Oh, how extremely lucky. Just then Helen's foot came down on mine. We are very glad to meet you. What do you teach? Our new friend helped himself carefully to the salad in front of him.
My specialty is Shakespeare. I teach English literature to the most advanced of our graduate students. They are valiant students, I must tell you.
How wonderful. I'm a graduate student myself, but in history in the United States.
A very fine field. I say, why don't you come to see our university while you are in Istanbul? I would be pleased to show you and your lovely wife around.
I registered a faint snort from Helen and hurried to cover for her. My sister. The Shakespeare scholar bowed to Helen over the table.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I am Dr. Turgut Bora, at your service.
We introduced ourselves, or I introduced us, because Helen kept obstinately silent. We shook hands all around, and there was nothing for us to do but to invite him to join us at our table. He protested politely, but only for a moment, and then sat down with us, bringing along his salad and his glass vase, which he immediately raised on high.
A toast to you, and welcome to our fair city. Cheerio!
Even Helen smiled slightly, although she still said nothing. How did you come to specialize in Shakespeare? And we began to eat our dinners again.
Ah, that is a strange story. My mother was a very unusual woman, brilliant, a great lover of languages, as well as a diminutive engineer. And she studied at the University of Rome, where she met my father. He, the delectable man, was a scholar of the Italian Renaissance, with a particular lust for...
At this very interesting point, we were suddenly interrupted by the appearance of a young woman peering in the arched window from the street. I took her for a gypsy. She could have been 15 or 40. It was impossible to read age on her thin face. In her arms she carried bunches of red and yellow flowers, which she apparently wanted us to buy. I was just getting out my wallet with the idea of presenting Helen, in jest, of course, with a Turkish bouquet, when the gypsy suddenly wheeled on her, pointing and hissing. Turgut started, and Helen, usually fearless, shrank back. This seemed to bring Turgut to life. He half stood and, with a scowl of indignation, began to berate the gypsy. It was not difficult to understand his tone and gestures, which invited her in no uncertain terms to take herself off. Helen spoke to Turgut for the first time.
What did she say?
Our new friend hesitated, as if he did not want to repeat the woman's words.
She used a word I will not translate, and then she said... Get out of here, Romanian daughter of wolves. You and your friend bring the curse of the vampire to our city.
I held the letters in my lap tightly, but my eyelids were beginning to droop. The pleasant-faced woman in the seat opposite was already dozing off, magazine in hand. My eyes had closed for just a second when the door to our compartment flew open. An exasperated voice broke in, and a lanky figure inserted itself between me and my daydream. It was Barley, mopping his forehead and scowling at me.
Well, for all the nerve. I thought so. I've been searching every car for you.
Barley was angry. I couldn't blame him, but this was a most inconvenient turn of events for me. And I was a little mad, too. It made me all the angrier that my first twinge of annoyance was followed by a secret swelling of relief. hadn't realized before seeing him how thoroughly alone I'd felt on that train.
Where in the bloody hell do you think you're going?
I evaded the last question for now. I didn't mean to worry you, Barley. I thought you'd gone on the ferry and would never know.
Yes, and hurry back to Master James, tell him you were safe in Amsterdam, and then got word that you'd vanished. Oh, I would have been in his good graces then.
He plunked himself down next to me, folded his arms and crossed his long legs.
You've been quite a bother this morning. I had to run around and get a ticket, and I almost didn't have enough guilders for it, too. And hunt through the whole train for you? And now it's been moving so long we can't get off right away.
I'm sorry, Barley. I didn't mean to involve you in this for a minute. He was clearly waiting for more enlightenment.
Yes? So you just had a little hankering for Paris instead of history class?
It's a long story, and I know you already think I'm strange.
You're awfully strange, but you better tell me what you're up to.
I swallowed. It's a long story.
When we have time.
Helen and Tirgut and I looked at one another around our little restaurant table, and I sensed a signal of kinship passing among us. Helen was silent.
Madam, you are Romanian? How did the gypsy woman know this? You did not speak to her.
I do not know.
Helen gave a helpless shrug. Tirgut shook his head.
Some people say that gypsies have the talent of special vision. I have never believed this, but...
He broke off and patted his mustache with his napkin.
How strange that she talked of vampires.
Is it? She must have been a crazy woman. Gypsies are all mad.
Perhaps. However, it is very strange to me the way she spoke, because that is my other speciality.
Gypsies?
No, good sir. Vampires.
Helen and I stared at him, carefully not meeting each other's eyes.
Shakespeare is my life's work, but the legend of the vampire is my hobby. We have an ancient tradition here of vampires.
Well, I didn't want to reveal too keen an interest, but Helen was staring at him, too. What about the legend of Dracula? Have you heard of that?
Ha! Heard of that?
His dark eyes shone and he twisted his napkin into a knot.
You know that Dracula was a real person, a figure of history? I do not mean to bore you, but I have a theory that Dracula is a very important figure in the history of Istanbul. It is known that when he was a boy, he was held captive by Sultan Mehmed II from 1442 to 1448, 6 long years. Dracula's father was not a gentleman either. The soldiers who guarded the boy Dracula were masters in the art of torture. And he must have learned too much when he watched them. But I have my own theory that he left his mark on them, too.
What on earth do you mean? My breath was coming short.
From about that time, there is a record of vampirism in Istanbul. It is my notion that his first victims were among the Ottomans, maybe the guards who became his friends. He left behind him contamination in our empire, I propose. And then it must have been carried into Constantinople with the conqueror.
We stared at him, speechless.
Well, excuse me for climbing up onto my soap dish. My wife says I am intolerable.
He beamed and toasted us.
But, by heaven, I have proof of one thing. I have proof that the sultans feared him as a vampire.
He gestured toward the ceiling.
Proof?
Yes. I discovered it some few years ago. The Sultan was so much interested in Vlad Dracula that he collected some of his documents and possessions here after Dracula died in Wallachia. Dracula killed many Turkish soldiers in his own country, and our Sultan hated him for this, but that was not why he founded this archive. No! The Sultan even wrote a letter to the Pasha of Wallachia in 1478, asking him for any writings he knew of about Vlad Dracula. Why? Because, he said, He was creating a library that would fight the evil Dracula had spread in his city after his death. I have even found this library.
Helen and I sat motionless. The coincidence was almost unbearably strange. I'd be very much interested in seeing this archive you found.
Of course, with great pleasure, I will show you. My wife will be astounded that anyone wants to see. If you like old curiosities, I will most joyfully take you there tomorrow.
Thank you very much. I didn't dare look at Helen.
Tell me, my fellows, what makes you to be interested in this topic of Dracula?
I glanced at Helen. Well, I'm studying the 15th century in Europe as background for my dissertation. How did you jump from Shakespeare to vampires? Tergut smiled. Sadly, it seemed to me, and his quiet honesty punished me further.
Ah, it is a very strange thing, a long time ago. You see, I was working on my second book about Shakespeare, The Tragedies. I sat to work every day in a little, a niche in our English room at the university. Then one day, I found a book I never saw there before.
He turned to me with that sad smile again. My blood had already run cold in every extremity.
This book was like no other. An empty book, very old, with a dragon in the middle and the word Dracula.
Barley and I had almost reached Brussels. It had taken me a long time, although it seemed like a few minutes, to tell Barley as simply and clearly as I could what my father had related of his experiences in graduate school. Barley stared past me out the window at the little Belgian houses and gardens, which looked sad under a curtain of clouds. I was about to embark on a description of my father's recent restlessness, his unhealthy pallor and strange behavior, when Barley suddenly turned to face me.
This is awfully peculiar. I don't know why I should believe this wild tale, but I do. I want to, anyway.
It struck me that I'd never before seen him look serious, only humorous or briefly annoyed. His eyes, blue as chips of sky, narrowed further.
The funny thing is that it all reminds me of something.
What? I was almost faint with relief at his apparent acceptance of my story.
Well, that's the odd thing. I can't think what. Something to do with Master James. But what was it?
Barley sat musing in our train compartment.
Well, you've got a strange story here, but I do want to believe you. As I see it, there are two possibilities. Either you're daft, in which case I have to stick with you and get you back home safely, or you're not daft, in which case you're headed for a lot of trouble, and I have to stick with you anyway.
He sighed and glanced at me, leaned back against the seat again.
I have this idea Paris is not going to be your terminal destination. Could you enlighten me about where you're going after that?
If Professor Bora had given us each a slap across the face at that pleasant restaurant table in Istanbul, it would not have been more stunning than what he told us about his eccentric hobby. He was talking to Helen now, and she, at last, was talking to him.
I do not know everything about Dracula's history. In truth, my knowledge is far from ravishing.
He glanced keenly from Helen to me.
You seem a portion interested in my topic yourselves. What is your dissertation about, exactly, young man?
Dutch mercantilism in the 17th century. It sounded lame to me, in any case, and I was beginning to wonder if it had always been a rather bland endeavor. Dutch merchants, after all, did not prowl the centuries attacking people and stealing their immortal souls. I thought Turgut looked puzzled.
Ah, well, if you are interested also in the history of Istanbul, you can come with me tomorrow morning to see Sultan Mehmed's collection. He was a splendid old tyrant. He collected many interesting things, in addition to my favorite documents. I must get home to my wife now, as she will be in a state of dissolution I am so late.
Turgut beamed, as if her state was more pleasant to anticipate than otherwise. He drew a little money out of nowhere and slid it under the edge of his plate.
So, my friends, adieu until the morrow.
Where shall we meet you?
Oh, I will come here to fetch you. Let us say exactly here at 10 o'clock in the morning. Good. I wish you a merry evening.
He bowed and was gone. I slept that night like the dead, as they say. When the sounds of the city woke me, it was already 7:30. I could hear Helen in the hall bathroom running water and moving around. After a moment, I realized this might constitute eavesdropping on her, and I felt ashamed. To cover my feeling, I got up quickly, ran water into the washstand in my room, and began to splash my face and arms. The little restaurant was empty when we entered, but a few minutes later, Turgut appeared in the doorway, nodding and smiling, and asked us how we had slept. His curly dark hair was slicked back, his shoes shone with polish, and he moved quickly to usher us out of the restaurant. As we followed Turgut through the streets, he explained to us that Sultan Mehmed's archive had been moved and was now housed in a library annex that had once been a medrese, a traditional Islamic school. The annex to the library proved to be an exquisite little building. We entered from the street through brass-studded wooden doors. The windows were covered with a tracery of marble. Sunlight filtered through them in fine geometric shapes. We proceeded into the collection's one room, a large, hushed space under a dome set with green and white mosaic. The librarian, a slender man of 50 with a string of prayer beads on his wrist, left his work and came over to shake both of Turgut's hands in his. They spoke for a minute, and then the librarian addressed us in Turkish, smiling and bowing.
This is Mr. Erozan. He welcomes you to the collection. He will set forth for you immediately Sultan Mehmed's documents from the Order of the Dragon. But first, we must sit in comfort here and wait for him.
We settled at one of the tables, carefully distant from the few other researchers. After a moment, Mr. Erozan came back carrying a large wooden box with a lock on the front and Arabic lettering carved into the top. What does that say? He touched the top of the box with his fingertips.
Ah, it says, here is evil contained, housed. Lock it with the keys of Holy Quran.
My heart made a jump. The phrases were strikingly similar to what Rossi had reported reading in the margins of the mysterious map, and had spoken aloud in the old archives where it had once been stored. Turgut beamed in Mr. Erazan's direction.
My friend told me once that these documents were put in the box in 1930 to keep them safe.
1930? Helen and I looked at each other. Rossi had penned his letters in December 1930. Turgut's friend had produced a ring of keys and was fitting one to the lock. It clicked.
Here we are.
Turgut murmured, and the librarian withdrew. Turgut smiled at each of us, rather sadly, I thought, and lifted the lid. As the lid went up on Sultan Mehmed's box of secrets, a smell I knew well drifted out of it. It was the scent of very old documents. It was the smell, too, of the small blank book with the dragon in the middle, my book. Turgut was gently lifting documents from the box. He spread them carefully on the table before us.
I will show you these papers myself and tell you what I know of them. Then perhaps you would like to sit and brood on them, don't you think?
Yes, perhaps we would. I nodded, and he unwrapped a scroll and unwound it delicately under our gaze. It was parchment attached to fine wooden spindles, very different from the large flat pages and bound ledgers I was used to in my research on Rembrandt's world.
This, my friends, is a ledger of the expenses of a war with the Order of the Dragon. It was written by a bureaucrat in a town on the southern side of the Danube, who was spending the Sultan's money there. It is a report of business, in other words. Dracula's father, Vlad Dracul, cost the Ottoman Empire a great deal of money in the mid-15th century, you see? Here it says that Vlad Dracul was an expense and a rotten nuisance, and had cost them more money than the Pasha wanted to spend.
Helen and I glanced at each other, and I thought I read in her eyes something of the awe I felt myself. This corner of history was as real as the tiled floor under our feet, or the wooden tabletop under our fingers. Turgut unrolled a smaller package, which contained a flat sketch on parchment.
A map.
I made an involuntary move for my briefcase, which held Rossi's sketches and notes, but Helen shook her head almost imperceptibly.
I have never been able to understand what this map is, my fellows.
I looked closely at the parchment, and saw with a thrill a neat, if faded version of the first map Rossi had copied, the long crescents of mountains, the curving river north of them.
It does not resemble any region I have studied myself, and there is no way to know the, how do you say, the scale of the map, you know? And you see, it is not much labeled, except for some lines from the Koran, and a strange motto. I translated it carefully once, that says something like, "Here he is housed with evil, reader, with your words dig him up."
I had put out a startled hand to stop him, but Turgut had spoken too quickly and caught me off guard. "No!" But too late, so that Turgut stared at me in astonishment. Helen looked from one of us to the other, and Mr. Arazon turned from his work on the other side of the hall and stared at me, too. "Excuse me, I'm just excited by seeing these documents. They're so interesting." At that moment, there was a step in the hall. I looked around nervously, half expecting to see Dracula himself, whatever he looked like, but it was only a small man in a crocheted cap and shaggy gray beard. Mr. Arazon went to the door to greet him, and we turned back to our documents. Turgut drew from the box another parchment.
"This I have never been able to make sense of. It is listed in the library catalogue as a bibliography of the Order of the Dragon."
My heart lurched, and I saw the color rise in Helen's face. "A bibliography?"
"Yes, my friend."
Turgut spread it gently on the table before us. It looked very old and quite brittle, written in Greek in a fine hand. Turgut took a notebook from his briefcase.
"I have had this translated by a scholar of Byzantium from our university. This is a list of works of literature, although many of them I have never found mentioned in any other example. Here, I shall translate for you as we go along, all right? Herodotus, The Treatment of Prisoners of War. Theseus, On Reason and Torture. Origen, Treatise on First Principles. Euthymius the Elder, The Fate of the Damned. Gubent of Ghent, Treatise on Nature. St. Thomas Aquinas, Sisyphus. You see, it is quite a strange selection, and some of the books on it are very rare."
"What do you make of this?" Helen's face said more plainly than any words, "We came all this way for a jumbled list of books? I know it makes no sense yet, but let's see what it leads to."
"Now then, my friends, let me read you the next few titles."
Turgut was writing cheerfully away.
"Erasmus, Fortunes of an Assassin. Enricus Curtius, The Cannibals. Giorgio of Padua, The Damned."
"No dates for these works are listed with them?" I bent over the documents.
"No, but the most recent of these works was written more than 100 years after Vlad Dracula's death, and after the death of Sultan Mehmed as well. Someone must have added it later, perhaps long after the collection came to Istanbul."
Then, suddenly, I saw something strange. My hand flew out toward the original Greek document, the bibliography of the Order of the Dragon. Not all of it was in Greek, after all. I could clearly read the name at the bottom of the list. Bartolomeo Rossi. It was followed by a phrase in Latin. Good God! My exclamation had ruffled the silent researchers all over the room, I realized too late. Mr. Arazon, still talking with the man in the cap and long beard, turned quizzically toward us. Turgut took alarm at once, and Helen moved swiftly closer.
What is it?
Turgut put out a hand toward the document. I was still staring. It was easy enough for him to follow my gaze. Then he jumped to his feet, breathing out what could have been an echo of my own agitation. So clear an echo that it brought me a strange comfort in the midst of all that other strangeness.
My God! Professor Rossi!
The three of us looked at one another, and for a moment nobody spoke. Finally, I tried, in a low voice. Do you know that name? Turgut looked from me to Helen.
Do you?
When Turgut uttered Rossi's name in that unmistakable tone of familiarity, I had the sudden sense of a world shifting, of bits of color and shape knocked out of place into a vision of intricate absurdity.
Do you know Professor Rossi?
I was still speechless, but Helen had apparently made a decision.
Professor Rossi is Paul's advisor in the history department of our university.
But that is incredible.
You knew of him?
I have never met him, but I heard of him in a most unusual way. Please, this is a story I must tell you, I think. Sit down, my fellows.
He gestured hospitably, even in the midst of his amazement.
Years ago, when I became enamored of this archive, I asked the librarian for all possible information about it. He told me that in his memory no one else had ever examined it, but that he thought his ancestor, I mean the librarian before him, knew something about it. I went to see the old librarian. His memory was excellent, and he told me that he had locked up the collection because he had a bad feeling about it. He said a foreign professor had looked at it once and then become very, how do you say, very upset and almost crazy and run out of the building suddenly. The old librarian said that a few days after this happened, he was sitting alone in the library one day with some work, and he looked up and suddenly noticed a large man examining the same documents. The door to the street was locked because it was evening. He could not understand how the man had got in. Then he told me that when he went close to the man to ask him what he was doing, the man looked up and, you see, there was a little bit of blood dripping from the corner of his mouth.
I felt a wave of revulsion, and Helen raised her shoulders as if to ward off a shudder.
The old librarian told me the sight made him feel faint, and when he looked again, the man was gone. But the documents were still scattered on the table, and the next day he bought this holy box in the antiques market and put the documents into it.
And what about Rossi?
I asked him for the foreign researcher's name, but he could not remember anything except that he thought it was Italian. He told me to look in the register for 1930 if I wanted to, and my friend here allowed me to do so. I found Professor Rossi's name after some searching.
Turgut turned to the parchment on the table, the bibliography, and his finger traced Rossi's name at the bottom. Looking at it, I noticed again the words after the name. They were Latin, I was sure, although my Latin had never been impressive and was now rusty to boot. What does that say?
It says, Bartolomeo Rossi, the spirit, the ghost, in the amphora.
My thoughts whirled. But I know that phrase. I'm sure that's the title of an article he's been working on this spring. I stopped. Was working on. He showed it to me about a month ago.
What is very, very strange is that I have looked at this list many times and I have never seen this entry on it. Someone has added Rossi's name.
I stared at him in amazement. When were you last here?
About 3 weeks ago. Wait, please, I will first go ask Mr. Erosan. Do not move.
But as he got up, the attentive librarian saw him and came to meet him. They exchanged a few quick words. What does he say?
Why did he not think to tell me this before? A man came in yesterday and looked through this box.
He questioned his friend further, and Mr. Erosan gestured at the door. Turgut pointed too.
It was that man. He says it was the man who came in a little while ago to whom he was talking.
Mr. Erosan seemed to be apologizing, and Turgut spoke with him for a few seconds. Then he turned to us again.
My friend the librarian says this man wanted to see the documents we have been examining, and he was angry when he found they were already being used. He says the man spoke Turkish, but with an accent, and he thinks he is a foreigner. My fellows, let us go out of here, but keep a close watch.
But the maps! It worried me to leave these precious items in their box. Besides, what had we learned?
Do not worry, Professor. I have made copies of all these things in my own hand, and the copies are safely in my apartment. Come. It seems to me we have much to discuss in private. I will take you to my apartment, and we will talk there.
In Paris, Barley and I changed trains, boarding the Southern Express to Perpignan. Barley swung his bag up the steep steps and reached out a hand to pull me up after him. There were fewer passengers on this train, and the compartment we found stayed empty even after the train pulled out. Watching Barley moving his lips over Milton made me sleepy, and when he said he wanted to go to the dining car for tea, I shook my head, drowsing. He smiled.
You're a wreck. You stay here and sleep then, and I'll take my book. We can always go back for dinner when you get hungry.
My eyes closed almost as soon as he left the car, and when I opened them again, I found I was curled up on the empty seat like a child, with my long cotton skirt pulled over my ankles. Someone was sitting on the opposite bench, reading a newspaper, and it was not Barley. I sat up quickly. The man across from me was reading Le Monde, and the spread of the paper hid the rest of him. I couldn't see anything of his upper body or face. A black leather briefcase rested on the seat next to him. I wondered in my discomfort if I might be able to get up and open the door to the compartment without his noticing me. Then I noticed that he had drawn the curtains to the aisle. No one walking through the train could see us, or had Barley drawn them before leaving to let me sleep. I snuck a glance at my watch. It was almost 5 o'clock. Outside, a tremendous landscape rolled by. We were entering the south. The man behind the newspaper was so still that I began to tremble in spite of myself. After a while, I realized what was frightening me. I had been awake for many long minutes by now, but during all the time I had been watching and listening, he had not turned a single page of his newspaper.
Turgut's apartment was located on the Marmara Sea, in the Asian side of the city, and we took a ferry there. Upon entering, we came first into a hall with a polished wooden floor and walls, where we followed Turgut in taking off our shoes and putting on the embroidered slippers he gave us. He settled us on the low furniture, close together, and I thought with contentment about all those time-honored objects signifying comfort. Cushion, divan, and, after all, ottoman. Turgut brought lunch in from a small kitchen across the hall, refusing our earnest offers of help. How he had rustled up a meal in such a short time eluded my imagination. It must have been waiting for him there. When we were nearly bursting, we leaned back against the low divans, and Turgut looked at us with satisfaction.
You are sure you have had enough?
Helen laughed, and I moaned a little, but Turgut refilled our glasses and coffee cups anyway.
Very good. Now, let us talk of the things we have not yet been able to discuss. First of all, I am astounded to think that you know Professor Rossi too, but I do not yet understand your connection. He is your advisor, young man?
And he sat down on an ottoman, leading toward us with an expectant air. I glanced at Helen, and she nodded slightly. Well, Professor Bora, I'm afraid we have not been completely open with you up to this point, but, you see, we are on a peculiar mission, and we have not known whom to trust. Haltingly, I told him about my bond with Rossi, my work with him on my dissertation, and the strange book I'd found in my library carrel. I told Turgut how Rossi had vanished and how I'd begun the search for him on my own, at first only half-believing his story. Here I paused again, this time to see what Helen would say. She stirred, and then to my surprise she picked up the tale herself and related to Turgut everything she had already told me. When Helen had rounded out the story, we all sat in silence for a moment. At last Turgut spoke.
Your experience is most remarkable, and I'm grateful that you tell me it. It is terrible, the disappearance of such a fine scholar. Professor Rossi was punished for something, or he is being punished right now as we sit here.
The languorous feeling cleared from my head in an instant, as if a cold breeze had swept it away. But what makes you so certain of this? And how on earth can we find him if this is true?
You have done the right thing, my colleagues, to come to Istanbul. If Professor Rossi is here, we will find him. I've long wondered myself if Dracula's tomb could be here in Istanbul. It seems to me that if someone has placed Rossi's name very recently in that bibliography, then there is a good chance Rossi himself is here, and you believe that Rossi will be found at Dracula's place of burial. I will devote myself entirely to your service in this matter. I feel responsible to you in this.
Now I have a question for you.
Helen narrowed her eyes at both of us.
Professor Bora, how did you come to be in our restaurant last night? It seems to me too much of a coincidence that you appeared when we had just arrived in Istanbul, looking for the archive you have been so much interested in all these years.
How did I come to meet you in the restaurant? I have asked myself this question several times, because I do not have an answer to it either. But I can tell you in all honesty, my friends, that I did not know who you were or what you were doing in Istanbul when I sat down near your table. Why did I go in there with my book for dinner? I see you are suspicious, madam. But I have no answer for you, except to say that the coincidence gives me hope. There are more things in heaven and earth.
He looked reflectively at both of us, and his face was open and sincere, and more than a little sad.
Please, come into my study for a moment.
I sat very, very still on my seat in the train, staring at the newspaper of the man who sat opposite me. After a moment, my worst fear was realized. He spoke without lowering the newspaper. His voice was quiet, cultivated.
Where is your father, my dear?
I tore myself from my seat and jumped toward the door. I heard his newspaper fall behind me, but all my concentration was on the latch. It was not locked. I got it open in a moment of transcendent fear. I slipped out without turning around and ran in the direction Barley had taken to the dining car. I remembered suddenly that I'd left our valises in the compartment on the overhead rack. Would he take those, search them? My purse was on my arm. I had fallen asleep with it slipped over my wrist, as I always wore it in public. Barley was in the dining car at the far end with his book open on a wide table. It took him a moment to glance up and register my presence. I must have looked wild because he pulled me into the booth at once.
What is it?
I put my face against his neck, struggling not to cry. I woke up and there was a man in our compartment reading the paper, and I couldn't see his face. Barley put a hand in my hair.
A man with a newspaper? What are you so upset about?
He didn't let me see his face at all. I turned to look at the entrance to the dining car. There was no one there, no dark-suited figure entering to search it. But he spoke to me behind the paper.
Yes?
Barley seemed to have discovered that he liked my curls. He asked me where my father was. Barley sat upright.
What? Are you sure?
Yes, in English. I sat up too. I ran, and I don't think he followed, but he's on the train. I had to leave our bags there. Barley bit his lip. I half expected to see blood well up against his white skin. Then he signaled to the waiter, stood, conferred with him for a moment, and fished in his pockets for a large tip which he left by his teacup.
Our next stop is Boulois. It's in 16 minutes.
What about our bags?
You've got your purse and I have my wallet.
Barley suddenly stopped and stared at me.
The letters?
They're in my purse.
Oh, thank God. We might have to leave the rest of the luggage, but it doesn't matter.
Barley took my hand and we went through the end of the dining car into the kitchen, to my surprise. The waiter hurried behind us, ushering us into a little niche near the refrigerators. Barley pointed there was a door next to it. There we stood for 16 minutes, I clutching my purse. It seemed only natural that we should stand holding each other tight in that small space, like two refugees. Suddenly I remembered my father's gift and put my hand up to it. The crucifix hung against my throat in what I knew was plain sight. No wonder that newspaper had never been lowered. At last the train began to slow. The brakes shuddered and squealed, and we stopped. The waiter pushed a lever and the door near us opened. He gave Barley a conspiratorial grin. He probably thought this was a comedy of the heart, my irate father chasing us through the train, something of that sort.
Step off the train, but stay right next to it.
Barley advised me in a low voice, and we inched together onto the pavement. There was a broad stucco station there, under silvery trees, and the air was warm and sweet.
Do you see him?
I peered down the train until finally I saw someone far along the line among the disembarking passengers. A tall, broad-shouldered figure in black. with something wrong about its entirety, a shadowy quality that made my stomach lurch. He wore a low, dark hat now, so that I couldn't see his face. He held a dark briefcase and a roll of white, perhaps the newspaper. That's him! I tried not to point, and Barley drew me rapidly back on the steps.
Stay out of sight. I'll watch where he goes. He's looking up and down.
Barley peered out, while I cowered resolutely back, my heart pounding. Barley kept a hard grip on my arm.
All right. He's walking the other way. No, he's coming back.
At that moment, the fans whirred. The train gave a heave and Barley swore.
Jesus, he's getting back on. I think he just realized we didn't really get off.
Suddenly, Barley jerked me off the steps and onto the platform. Next to us, the train heaved again and started up. Several of the passengers had put the windows down and leaned out to smoke or gaze around. Among them, several cars away, I saw a dark head turned in our direction, a man with his shoulders squared. He was full, I thought, of a cold fury. Then the train was picking up speed, pulling around a curve. I turned to Barley and we glared at each other. Except for a few villagers sitting in the little rural station. We were alone, in the middle of a French nowhere.
The first impression I had of Turgut's study was the immediate sense of a dark presence, an obsession that had gradually overcome the milder influence of the English works he wrote about. The presence leaped out at me suddenly as a face that was everywhere, meeting my gaze with arrogance from a print behind the desk, from a stand on the table, from an odd piece of embroidery on one wall, from the cover of a portfolio, from a sketch near the window. It was the same face in every case, caught in different poses and different media, but always the same gaunt-cheeked, mustached, medieval visage. Turgut was watching me.
Ah, you know who this is. I have collected him in many forms, as you can see.
We stood side by side, looking at the framed print on the wall behind the desk. It was a reproduction of a woodcut like the one I'd seen at home, but the face was fully frontal, so that the ink-dark eyes seemed to bore into ours. Where did you find all these different images?
Anywhere I could.
Turgut gestured toward the folio on the table.
Sometimes I had them sketched from old books, and sometimes I found them in antique shops or at auctions. It is extraordinary how many pictures of his face still float loose in our city once you are watching out for them. I felt that if I could gather them all, I might be able to read the secret of my strange empty book in his eyes. But these woodcuts are so crude, so black and white. I could not be satisfied with them. And finally I asked a friend of mine, who is an artist, to blend them all into one for me.
He led us to a niche by one window, where short curtains, also black velvet, were drawn closed over something. I felt a kind of dread even before he put his hand up to pull the cord, and when the cleverly made drapery parted under his grasp, my heart seemed to turn over. The velvet opened to reveal a life-size and radiantly lifelike painting in oils, the head and shoulders of a young, thick-necked, virile man. His hair was long, heavy black curls tumbled around his shoulders. The face was handsome and cruel in the extreme. It was a face full of life, but completely devoid of compassion, brimming with strength and alertness, but without stability of character. Helen, standing next to me, moved a little closer to my shoulder, more as if to offer solidarity than to comfort herself.
This is an idea of how Vlad Dracula appeared around 1456, when he began his longest rule of Wallachia. He was 25 years old and well-educated by the standard of his culture, and he was a very good horseman. In the next 20 years, he killed perhaps 15,000 of his own people, sometimes for political reasons, often for the pleasure of watching them die.
Turgut closed the curtain, and I was glad to see those terrible bright eyes extinguished. He indicated a wooden cabinet on the wall.
I have some other curiosities here to show you. This is a seal from the Order of the Dragon, which I found in an antiques market down near the old city port. And here, my fellows, is a prize.
From the edge of his desk, he took a beautifully inlaid wooden box and unhooked the clasp. Inside, among folds of rusty black satin, lay several sharp tools that looked like surgical instruments, as well as a tiny silver pistol and a silver knife. Helen reached a tentative hand toward the box, then drew it back.
What is that?
It is an authentic vampire hunting kit, 100 years old. I believe it to be from Bucharest. A friend of mine who is a collector of antiques found it for me several years ago. There were many of these. They were sold to travelers in Eastern Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries.
He invited us to sit down on some rickety chairs upholstered in damask. The back of mine seemed to be inlaid with a piece of... was it bone? I didn't lean against it. Tergut pulled a heavy file from one of the bookcases. Out of it he took hand-drawn copies of the documents we had been examining in the archives, sketches similar to Rossi's, except that these had been made with greater care. Next, Tergut brought out a small book bound in ancient leather. It was difficult for me not to reach for it at once, but I waited in a fever of self-control while Tergut gently opened it and showed us first the blank leaves in front and back, and then the woodcut in the center. I opened my briefcase, which I had brought in with me, and took out my own book. Tergut put the two volumes side by side on the desk. Each of us compared his treasure with the other's evil gift, and we saw together that the two dragons were the same, his filling the pages to their edges, the image darker, mine more faded, but the same. The same.
It is remarkable. I never dreamed of such a day when I would see a second book like this.
He was spreading his copies of the maps next to our books and comparing with a large finger the outlines of dragons and river and mountains.
Amazing. To think I never saw this myself. It is indeed similar, a dragon that is...
His eyes gleamed. That is what Rossi was trying to figure out in the archives here. If only he had taken more steps later to find out what it meant.
Perhaps he did.
Helen's voice was thoughtful, and I turned to her to ask what she meant. At that moment the door opened and we both jumped. Instead of some horrible apparition, however, a small, smiling lady in a green dress stood in the doorway. It was Turgut's wife, and we all rose to meet her. Tergut drew her quickly in. He made gallant introductions all around, and Mrs. Bora shook our hands with an affable smile. She was exactly half Turgut's size, with long-lashed green eyes, a delicately hooked nose, and a swirl of reddish curls.
I am very sorry I do not meet you here before. Probably my husband does not give you any food, no?
We protested that we had been beautifully fed, but she shook her head.
We must eat dinner. I hope that you will eat dinner.
She turned to us. The thought of more food was impossible, and I was careful not to meet Helen's eye. Helen, however, seemed to find this all normal.
Thank you, Mrs. Bora. You are very kind. But we should return to our hotel, I think, because we have an appointment there at 5 o'clock.
We did? This was perplexing, but I played along.
I shall immediately look through everything in my library here that might be of help to us. We must think about the possibility that Dracula's tomb is in Istanbul. I have a few old books about the city here, and friends who have fine collections about Istanbul. I will search everything for you tonight.
Dracula. I like Shakespeare better than Dracula. A more healthier interest.
When the Perpignan Express had disappeared completely beyond the silvery trees and village roofs, Barley shook himself.
Well, he's on that train, and we're not.
Yes, and he knows exactly where we are.
Not for very long.
Barley marched over to the ticket window, where one old man seemed to be falling asleep on his feet, but he soon came back looking chastened.
The next train to Perpignan isn't until tomorrow morning, and there's only one boarding room at a farm about a half kilometer outside the village. We can sleep there and walk back for the morning train.
Either I could get angry or I was going to cry. Barley, I can't wait till tomorrow morning to take a train to Perpignan. We'll lose too much time.
Well, there's nothing else. I asked about cabs, cars, farm trucks, donkey carts, hitchhiking. What else do you want me to do?
come to my room. We need to talk in private.
In her room, the bed was neatly made and her few belongings apparently stowed out of sight. She sat down on the window seat and gestured me to a chair. She pulled off her gloves and took off her hat.
Look,